Parshas Vayesara really could be broken down into two, maximally three parts, main parts, shall we say. And of course, the beginning of Vayesara describes in some detail, actually, the purchase of Maaret HaMachpelah. And Mefarshim, Rishonim already, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, and others raised the question, or are very intrigued, by the fact that the Torah devotes so many psukim, there's a 20 or so psukim, devoted to the purchase of Maaret HaMachpelah. And there are a number of different directions, approaches taken by the Mefarshim. Actually, the Gemara itself has already spoken about this. The Talmud in Maseches Bava Basra, in the end of the first perek, explains that what we see here is the Maila of Avram Avinu. We see the great heights of Avram, because the truth of the matter is, as according to Rashi, there's a certain reference to this in Avram's words, but Avram was promised the land. And therefore, one certainly would have expected that in his time of need, and the entire country belongs to him, ultimately, so the most basic requirement of a plot of land to bury sorrow would be made available to him in a somewhat straightforward way. And this was not the case, but rather there were protracted negotiations with cunning people who were looking to perhaps take advantage of him at that time. And in a sense, this is certainly one of the reasons why some Mefarshim considered this to be one of the 10 tests of Avram. Whereas the more common notion, well-known notion, is that the Akedah was the final test. But there are some Mefarshim, Rabbeinu Yonah and his Perish to Pirkei Avos and others, who explain that this is also a Nisoyon. This is the Nisoyon number 10. It's really a Nisoyon of how he relates to the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised him the land, and how much he had to part with in order to get the most simple necessity at that time, which was a place to bury sorrow. And how much did it cost him in the end? What we have here is Shvocho Shel Avram Avinu, that he went through with it, didn't complain. As we know, he ended up paying 400 shekels. Before the invention of the modern shekel, this was worth a lot of money. And important to remember that. As the Pasuk states, Pasuk test Vav, here's Ephraim talking. Adonishim o'eini, Eretz abamir shekel kesef, benio ben chamahi, a land of 400 shekels. What is that between us? Ves mescha kevor, proceed. Now, as soon as Ephraim mentions money, and a very specific amount of money, so hearing between the lines, between the airwaves, Avram understands that will be the price. But Yishma Avram as El Ephron, Avram hears Ephron very well, loud and clear. Message received by Yishkol Avram to Ephron, Es HaKesef Asher Diber Bo Aznei V'nei Ches. He mentions the amount of money that he had spoken about in the ears of B'nei Ches. Arba Meir Shekel Kesef, Over La Socher. Over La Socher means anyone would take them. Now, there is a certain aspect of what's going on here that needs to be understood. Because it sounds to us, on a straightforward level, that it wasn't really polite to mention the amount of money that it was worth, really, especially if you were genuine in not wishing to take any money. To say, I would never dream of taking exactly 400 shekels from you. That's already considered improper. But at the very least, we are left to understand that if we were to put a value to this land, it would be 400 shekels. Let us see whether that sounds reasonable. How shall we proceed? In Parshas Vayishlach, the Torah tells us that when Yaakov returned with his family and with all of his possessions, he needed a place to live. He bought a plot of land, Chelkas Ha'aretz. For how much? The Torah says, "Vayiken eschelkas haaretz b'meya kesita," for 100 kesita. Now, let us try and find out how much is a kesita. It happens to be, as the Mefarshim talk about this, Chazal talk about this, a kesita, or 24 kesita, equal a shekel. Okay? Now we know. And if that is the case, then we understand that 100 kesita, which is the price that he paid, works out to be just over 4 shekels. 4.15 for the yekas amongst us. Now, bear in mind, this is an amount of money that will buy you a plot of land that could house or cater for Yaakov with his family and his servants and his livestock. That's 4.15. Okay. That's the going rate, so it would seem. But to add insult to injury, the very next parsha, of course, is the very difficult parsha of Shechem, Shechem and Dina. And how does it begin? It begins by Shechem talking to Dina. Vayidaber aleif hana'ara. He tries to talk to her, to endear himself to her. Now, I don't know if the male psyche has developed that much, but according to Rashi, the way that he thought he would endear himself to her is by saying that the amount of money that her father paid for the place that they live, he could have gotten for it cheaper. It's not the most endearing of topics, but one has to start somewhere. What does that mean? He says, Avicha, you know, if you would have come to me, I would have gotten you, your father was overcharged. That's overcharged by Dabera Leif Hana'ara. The real price is much less than 100 kesita. And so when we put all of this together, how are we to understand that Ephron has the gall to pretend that Marasa Machpela, that which at the time is just a cave, they didn't have the building at the time, it's just a cave, 400 shekel, kesef, and how can you suggest that? Says the Be'er Yosef, I believe this is the most basic point in pshat, pure pshat. Says the Be'er Yosef, Ephron never intended to say, or never communicated the notion, never claimed that the plot for Marasa Machpela was 400 shekels. He never said that. He said something else. He said, a plot of land of 400 shekels is nothing between us. Now the question is, if we would stop Ephron at that time, do you mean to say that this plot of land is worth 400 shekels? Not at all. I'm not talking about this plot of land. As if this plot of land is probably worth 2 or 3, if you make the cheshbon according to Yaakov's purchases, 2 or 3 maximally. But what I mean to say is, because this is Ephron being magnanimous, what I mean to say is, even a plot of land worth 400 shekels, this is, it's a kal v'chomer 100 times over, even 400 shekels. I never meant to say that this is 400 shekels, so what's the point? The point is that through all of the magnanimity and through all of the ostentation, there's a group of people there. They're called B'nai Ches. They're a very interesting group. They don't really do much except they bow and are bowed to. But they're a crowd and they're there. And crowds tend to hear. And what do they hear? They hear highlighted words, headline words, like gift, 400 shekels, cave. The nuance of the gesture of Ephron will be lost within moments. And everybody else, all that they will go home with, which is the highlights of the day, is, so it was 400 shekels, but Avram didn't even pay for it, and Ephron gave it to him, and the moral of the story is Avram owes Ephron 400 shekels. That was the deviousness of Ephron. In other words, when he's talking in theory, he can name a price as much as he wants because he doesn't mean it. But the Pasuk says, Avram heard, and he paid out the money, Esakesef asher diber ba'oznei b'nei ches. Those are the critical words. This was the sum of money that was pronounced loud and clear for a large group of people called b'nei ches. They'll remember that number. And Avram will not emerge clean until he pays that amount, even though it ended up being at least a hundredfold from what he needed to pay as a result of Ephron's so-called gesture. That's called Reshoim Omrim Harbe Ba'afilu Ma'at. That really is Harbe. Okay, so I really think that that is a very interesting insight. Absolutely al derech hashem. Now, what's very interesting is there's a follow-up point here, and it comes from the fact that at a certain point so far, Ephron has just been talking about, I'll give it to you, and Avram says, I'll pay for it. And at a certain point, Ephron mentions a sum of money, however much it was, an exorbitant amount. But he shifted gears, because until now it's a gift, and all of a sudden a price has been attached. So the question is, how are we to understand the development that all of a sudden Ephron becomes conscious, or at least receiving money for it? So there is a fascinating answer to this question, which was given by the Ostrovtzer Rebbe. The Ostrovtzer Rebbe, Rav Meir Yechiel of Ostrovtzer, in the Sefer Or Torah, my father, Zechoron Levracha, referred to him once in private conversation as the last of the Hasidic Rebbes. That's how he referred to him. I didn't really follow up exactly what he meant by that, and I can't really ask anyone else, but he had a very, very high regard for this Rav Meir Yechiel.
What years would he may have lived, approximately?
Early 1900s. Oh. And it's actually based on a vort of the Vilna Gaon, what is attributed to the Vilna Gaon. There is a phrase that recurs throughout the beginning of Parshas Chayesara, and that is the phrase, Kevor Mesecha, Bekbara es Mesi, right, to bury the dead. It comes back again and again. Specifically, the words of Kavura and Misa appear seven times in these opening psukim, within different contexts, different people, all together, make a cheshbon, seven times. Okay. What's interesting is, which is a lot when you think about it, although of course everything here was very wordy, there was a lot of nimusim, a lot of protocol that had to be gone through. But another interesting ha'ara is that the seventh time is different than the first six. For of these two expressions, kavura and misa, for the first six times the word kavura appears first. Ekbara, es mesi, kavur, mesecha, and that's how it goes. It's only the seventh time, Ephron says, well, the seventh and last time, the end of Pasuk Tes, Vav ve'es mescha kavur. He shifts round and mentions Misa before Kavura. Okay, what to make of all of this? So the Vilna Gaon, in typical style one may say, for the Vilna Gaon was of the approach, Lekemidi de la remise be'arai. So there is nothing that is said by Chazal that is not alluded to in the Torah. Not only did he have that as a matter of reproach, but of course he was the Vilna Gaon, and therefore on many occasions demonstrated that that is the case. Now, the place that we are talking about is Chevron hi Kiryas Arba. Kiryas Arba hi Chevron. Why is it called Kiryas Arba? Rashi gives two perushim, and one of the perushim is because there were Arba Zugos that were buried there. You have the four famous couples, that's where they are. Adam and Chava actually are the first two. Avram and Sarah, Yitzhak and Rivka, and Yaakov and Leah. They are the Arba, after which the Torah calls it Kiryas Arba. Now, that being the case, so we have an interesting situation, because the immediate pressing need to purchase Maris HaMachpelah, to attain Maris HaMachpelah, is for purposes of Sarah. There's no question about that. Sarah is now the one who needs to be buried there. Correct? And that's why everyone wants this place. However, he is also aware that there will be other people buried there. Now, Adam and Chava have already been buried there, but there are still six tzaddikim who will be buried there. They are Sarah and Avram, Yitzhak and Rivka, and Yaakov and Leah. And that is why we have the first six Kavur Mesechas, because there are six who will yet find their place in Ma'aras HaMachpelah. But, as we noted, there are seven references to Misa and Kavura. Who is number seven? Now, as we know from the Talmud in Masechet Sota, number 7 is the less likely of anyone to find his way into such august company, and that is Esav. Because at the time that they brought Yaakov back to bury him in Maaseh Machpelah, Esav turned up, contested the burial, negotiations began, everybody got involved, except for Hushim ben Dan. Hushim ben Dan, who couldn't hear, so was not involved in any of this, he didn't know what was going on. All he knew was that his grandfather was Mutal Babizayun. He's just lying there, they're not burying him, and Esav is the reason for it. And at a certain point, he'd had enough. He took a pole, depending on your version, pole, sword, whatever it would be, and he gave Esav a knock on the back of the head that knocked his head off his shoulders. And Esav's head rolled into the Maaseh Machpelah. So the full ensemble of people who are in Maaseh Machpelah is Adam and Chava, Avram and Sarah, Yitzhak and Rivka, Yaakov and Leah, and Esav's head. That is the full tally. Yeah. My father once commented that Esav had a literature cup. In terms of ideas, his questions about Trumas and Mysus and things like that, he was a Rosh Hashiva. Nothing meaningful ever made it from the neck downwards, that's all. So his head is no different than anyone else's head. It's also in Maaseh Machpelah. Says the Gaon, there is a principle that the Talmud states, Tzadikim, afilu b'misosam keruim chayim. The righteous, even after they've departed, they're still considered to be alive. Now that means many things, but on a certain level, the Gemara says, even physically, they do not reach the full state of death until just before Tchias HaMesim. Rishorim, on the other hand, afilu bechayeyem keruyim mesiv, even when they're alive, they're of no use to anyone, they're considered to be mesim, considered to be dead. Therefore, says the Vilna Gaon, this is why there are 7 references to Kavura in the beginning of the Parsha, because there are 7 who will yet be buried. But number 7 is different than the first 6. For the first 6 being tzaddikim, their Kavura will precede the Misa, because afilu b'misosam keruyim chayim. But for number 7, his Misa preceded his Kavura, because even when he was alive, afilu b'chayim keruyim mesim. Adkan, in the name of the Vilna Gaon. Now, what's interesting is that Reb Meir Yechiel now takes this vort, and he's a Hasidic Rebbe, and he gets hold of this Litvish vort from the Vilna Gaon, so what's going to happen? So he says, just to add, that we find, and of course, this must be subliminally within Ephron. Ephron never mentions a price. As long as he's talking, please, no, it's Meislog, Meislog, Kavor. All of those earlier psukim are references to all of the tzaddikim. That Ephron cannot bring himself to even mention how much money the place is worth. But the final pasuk, Ves Meischa Kavor, which is pasuk Tesvav, is the final reference to Esav. And at that point, even Ephron's magnanimity runs out. And he cannot help but say, for Esav, I mean, this place is worth a lot of money. And that's the point where the price comes out. So it's very interesting. Dak al derech haremez. That's the famous comment of Reb Meir Yechiel of Ostrovtsa. Now, I'd like to come to what is certainly the central part of the parasha, and that is Eliezer's quest for a wife for Yitzchak, and to zone in on one of the well-known issues in terms of parshanut, and it begins in Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Kaf Beis. Rivka has passed the test with flying colors. She was asked, Hagmi inina, ma'atman mikadech, and she just goes above and beyond. She offers to, and does, give only not only him, also all the camels. And at that point, Eliezer is more or less convinced that it's her. Pasuk kaf beis, vayehi. When all the camels had finished, and she's not asking for anything, and that's why Eliezer waits. She didn't ask for any compensation, not before, not during, and not at the end. That's it. She's just about to wish him a good day. And in a sense, that was when she passed to the test, because who knows what the fee will be, you know, until the end. You never know. There was nothing. Kasher kilu agmalim nishtos vayikach ha'ish nezem zahav deka mishkalo. So he takes these gifts, right? So that means in Pasuk Kaf Beis, when it actually happened, right, in real time, when this events occurred, so first he gives her the gifts, and then in the next Pasuk, Kaf Gimel, he asks her who she is. And of course, she is Rivka. As we know, when he tells over the story to, and there's a great deal of space given to his retelling, Yofa Sichosan Shel Avdei Avos, in Pasuk Mem Zayin, as he retells, he says, V'ashalosa, I asked her, Bas Miat, who are you? She told me she's Bas Besua Ben Nochor, she told me who she is, and only then does he say, V'asimanez Malapavat Midim Al Yadeha. So the question is, what is at the bottom of this reversal of events between the way they actually happened, whereby first he presented the gifts and then asked who she is, but when he told over the story, he swapped it round. And Rashi talks about this, everyone talks about this, Rishonim. And interestingly, there is an approach, there is a school amongst the Mefarshim who at the very least maintain that there is no actual contradiction between these two events. As if to say, what we are dealing with, according to these Mefarshim, is not a reversal of events. Now, how can they say that? I mean, the Psukim switched them around. In reality, when it happened, you had the gifts and then the question. And when he retells it, there's the question, then the gifts. How can they maintain that there has been no reversal? Except, interestingly, if we look carefully, very carefully, at Pasuk Kaf Beis, we will see, and it will not answer everything, but it will open things for us. Pasuk Kaf Beis, Vayihi ka'asher kilu hagmalim lishtos. Vayikach ha'ish nezem zahav. So after the camels have finished drinking, Vayikach ha'ish nezem zahav. He took the ring. Beka mishkalo. The Pasuk has not said that he gave her anything. All it said is that he took it. Now that's a very specific choice of verb, vayikach. Contrast this with what he says later on when he says, va'asim atzmidim al yadeha v'nezem al apah. He said, I gave them to her. He actually says, he put them on her. That's something else. This Pasuk Kaf Beis does not refer to him giving her anything. On the contrary, he's only taking, which of course needs to be understood. He doesn't need to take anything. They're all his anyway. In the beginning, Vayikach ha'ish nezem zahav. Now, the remainder of Pasuk Kaf Beis, Ushnei tzmidim al yadeha. If this is correct, then Shnei tzmidim al yadeha still would have to not mean that he actually gave her anything yet, but rather two bracelets to go on her hands, al yadeha, for her hands, but he hasn't given her anything yet. If that's true, then actually the full cohesion of the earlier psukim and the later psukim is integral. Meaning, first he took them out, then he asked her who she was, and when she said who she was, he gave them to her. So that means that there is no contradiction per se. But that doesn't mean that there is no question. The question still remains, why is it that the Pasuk tells us that he took them out before he asked the question, and why does he not mention that? That question still remains. That there has been a stress on different aspects of what has happened. And of course, all of this will lead us to another question. I mean, the most basic question, which is, why is he taking out these gifts before he asks her the question? In other words, it's neither here nor there. He hasn't given her anything, but he's taking them out. Well, what is that meant to mean? It's neither here nor there. So Rav Hirsch explains, classic comment, and the truth is that the question that he highlights is such a stunning part of the story that really I spent most of the morning trying to get over the fact that it had never hit me before. Because Rivka here is a source of kindness, and Eliezer has a test for her, and she passes the test. What's the test? He asks her for some water. She not only gives him water, but she gives also the camels. That's that. You couldn't ask for more. And then he asks for more. And in fact, he asks for much more, when you think about it. Because the run of events is, it's interesting, when we, in our minds, we tell over the story more or less ends where he says, give me some water, and then she waters the camels also. And that's the end of the story. That's not the end of the story. The next part of the story, Eliezer says, can we stay at your house? That's amazing. And the truth is that it's very nice for her to offer to water the camels, and I guess you'll be being on your way now. Well, actually, we were hoping that we could all come and stay with you, all 10 of us and all of our camels. How about that? Now, that has to dwarf anything that's happened so far. Most people would do a favor, put themselves out, but doing a favor for someone in the street is one thing. Having them come to live with you until further notice is quite another thing. But the test is over. So what is this? That's a good question. And the follow-up question, which is equally important, is the answer to this question, can we come and stay at your house, is not up to her. She can't answer that question meaningfully because it's not her house. As long as she, according to Rashi, she's 3 years old. According to other Mepharshim, she's 14. Either way, she does not own the house. I mean, with Lavan there and everybody else there, I doubt she gets a say in what goes on. Especially about Hachnosas Orchim on this type of scale. So that's very interesting now, because Eliezer is actually asking her a question that she can't answer. He seems to be almost putting her in an unfair position. He's saying, could we stay at your house? The answer probably is no, because the house is owned by Besuel and Lavan, and they don't like guests. That's the unpleasant truth. So why is Eliezer asking her? And that is why, says Rav Hirsch, Eliezer at this point, before he does anything else, until now it's been pure chesed. It's been purely to see, is she the one for Yitzhak? And the answer is yes, and the test is over. For what happens now, it's got nothing to do with testing Rivka anymore. It's got to do with finding a place to stay. At this point, Eliezer can no longer rely not on her kindness or even anybody else's kindness. And that is why he removes very valuable things in order for her to realize that beyond this point, he is entirely capable of paying his way. Not only for her, because it's unfair at this point for her to think any otherwise, but she doesn't. There will be no conversation taking place with her brother and with her parents. He knows. He knows what the people of Aram are like. He knows what Avram's family is like. He's been told. And therefore, she needs, when she goes back home and say, I met this person at the well, she can't be left just saying, there's this person at the well, there's nowhere to stay. I filled up his camels for him, and now he wants to stay at our house. That can't work. And therefore, she needs to be able to stay in for Lavan's sake. She needs to be able to let them know that this person is someone of means. He can more than pay his way. And of course, Lavan runs out, which means it worked. But that's more about Eliezer vis-a-vis Lavan. So this explains to us what's behind this kind of half measure before he asks her, who are you, and is there a place where we can stay? It's only fair at this stage that she realizes that he is not going to be asking an unending string of kindnesses from her and her family. That said, Eliezer makes no mention of this when he tells over the story. Rather, the only mention we will have of the jewelry is when she's already said who she is, and then I gave her these gifts, and it's all wonderful. Why is there no mention of having shown the gifts to her beforehand? The answer, says Rav Hirsch, is because now her family has already said yes. Once the family has already said yes, and you are enjoying their hospitality, so then it is not courteous for you to mention that I showed her that I'm capable of paying my way before I asked if she could stay? Because really what you're saying to the family is, because otherwise there was no way that you would have let me stay. Now, that happens to be true, but once you're in their house, it has to become untrue in terms of being a good guest. And that's why that part of the story is deleted. No one needs to know about that anymore. All, as we know, the facts as we remember them is, I asked if you could stay, and of course you wonderful people says, yeah, yes, I could, and here I am. So that is a fantastic insight, once again, al derech ha-pshat from Rav Hirsch. And the truth is, and this really brings us on to Eliezer, everything Eliezer does, as he tells his story, is geared towards this outcome, namely, to have Lavan and his family looking favorably on the idea of sending Rivka to Avraham. And therefore, this is an example. He doesn't do anything that will cause ill feeling. He misses out part of the story that reflect badly on them. And it's all wonderful because the only positive result will be for them to say, take Rivka, she's the one for Yitzchak. So much so that this year I got new insight into a Rashi. We must quote this Rashi every year. And that is in Pasuk Lamedtes. He's telling over the story from the beginning. And my master told me not to take a wife from Benos HaKnani, but rather to go back to the family. Pasuk Lamedtes. Va'omar el Aduni. I said to him, Ulai lo telecha isha acharai. Maybe she won't want to come. And he said to me, then forget about it. If she doesn't, there's no way that Yitzhak is going back. He's not leaving Eretz Yisrael, so then just forget about it. Now, that's true, by the way. In other words, that really happened, as we know. Earlier on in the Perikum, Laila Tove Ha'isha Lelecha Zacharai, Ha'ashivesh Ives Bincha, should I bring your son there? And Avram said no. So this is a retelling of that part of the story. However, Rashi notes for us that if you look at the word Ulai, in Pasuk Lamedtes, it is written without a vav. Ulai, without a ra, a vav, could be read as Eli, to me. What does that mean? Eli ksiv. There's a connotation of to me. What does that mean? As we know, bas hoyseloli Eliezer, because Eliezer had his own daughter, v'hayo mechazer limso Eli. He was looking for some type of pretext, some type of possibility, Sheyomalo Avram, Lifno Selavlo, Siabito. So he was looking to open up the possibility that maybe it won't work out there, but of course, you know, we can always maybe think about her, Yitzhak, marrying my daughter. What about that? So Ulai becomes Eli. If that doesn't work, what about me? Amalo Avram. So Avram said, a disappointing answer for Eliezer. Bini Baruch, my son is blessed. Va'ata Aror, you are cursed. That's quite a thing to say to Eliezer, his trusted servant. It's not personal, but he's Kanani. Ve'ein Aror medabik b'baruch. Aror and Baruch doesn't go together. So I'm sorry, but no. Now, there's a lot to say about that, but the question, the pressing question in terms of Rashi is, why does Rashi not talk about this when it actually happened? In other words, earlier in the Perek, when Eliezer actually says it, why is there no comment here? Why does Rashi say, you know, when he said Ulai, really he meant because he had a daughter, and Rashi doesn't talk about it. Now the truth of the matter is, that is not a fair question. Because Rashi doesn't talk about it because he has no reason to. Rashi's comment is responding to the fact that the Pasuk wrote the word Ulai without a Vav. Ulai without a Vav sounds like, reads like, Eli. So Rashi responds. The Pasuk only said that now. The first time round it was Male, with a Vav. So, Lo al Rashi teluno seinu ki il ala Pasuk. We have no problems with Rashi. Rashi just responds, we're relevant. But in a sense, the question has now moved further up. Because the question is, well, why would the Torah only make reference to this the second time around. It cannot be true the second time around if it wasn't true the first time. He can't retell something if it didn't actually happen at the time. That is the question. And Maharal explains in the Guru Arya that between Avram and Eliezer, this was not a major part of their conversation. As if to say, it was nipped in the bud, it was half a havamina that Eliezer had, maybe Avram said, no, don't think, put that aside, that's not going to happen, let's get back to business. So it didn't really cause much of a murmur within Avram's conversation with Eliezer. When it comes to Eliezer telling over the story, however, it's important that they should know. He makes more of a mention as he retells the story. He pushes it out. And when he retells the story, more than when it actually happened. When it actually happened, yes, no, nothing, okay, moving on. But when he retells the story, he wants them to know about this. That's interesting. When the Pasuk says Eli in his words, it's because he is pronouncing it more. Why? It won't be obvious to them if he doesn't make it obvious, and he wants to make it obvious. Why does Eliezer want to make this obvious to them? I'm not exactly sure. This is a fascinating question that has probably a very large answer to it. But how exactly did Eliezer communicate this with the word ulai, given that the only difference is how it's spelt? And it's presuming he did not write the story out to them, but rather he said it to them. So ulai without a vav sounds exactly the same as ulai with a vav. So unless they had Rashi, which of course they didn't, they would miss this. But at least the beginning of the answer, of course, is that he didn't say ulai to them. There's no reason to assume that he even spoke Hebrew to them. Ulai is the Torah compacting for us and Torah formatting for us the distillation of everything we need to know about what he said. Which means that it could be in conversation, he actually said to them explicitly, you know, this story. The Torah doesn't need to say it explicitly. For our purposes, the Torah can communicate this by reading ulai as Eli. That's a very interesting question, yeah? The first question is what happened? The second question is how does the Torah talk about it? Ma Talmud Lomar. Now, why does he want them to know? Says Maharal, and this is really, it's a bittersweet comment of the Maharal. Because, as we said before, Eliezer, he is Eved Avram, first and foremost. And on his shlichus here, he is prepared to do whatever it takes in order for this to have a positive outcome. It's clear to him that Rivka is the one. It needs to be clear to them that Rivka is the one. Whatever he can say that will push them in that direction, he will say. Even something that is a built on his inadequacy, on his shortcoming. For what is he saying? He's saying to them, listen, Rivka is the one for Yitzhak. That's really, that's the moral of the story here. And let me tell you something else. Eliezer was a very impressive person. I mean, as the Eved Avram and an executor of the estate, he's a very impressive person. So Eliezer says, you should know. I'm an impressive person. But I'm not good enough for Avram's daughter, for Avram's son. You have to know. I thought I was, and I'm not. But your daughter is. In other words, he's prepared really to trample on his own covert. If it just helps, there's another nudge for them to realize, well, we have a great opportunity. Look at Eliezer. He's the most impressive person we've ever seen. And now he just told us that he's not good enough for Avram's son. And he wants our daughter. You know, just, we should really do this. And that's the greatness of Eliezer, Eved Avram. That he could have made as little of it as it was at the time. It's not a key part of the story. But anything that will persuade them, including Eliezer saying, you know, I have a serious problem and I'm not good enough for Avram's son. If it will help the cause, he'll say it. That's Eved Avram. And the truth is that, as we mentioned in the past, Eliezer, who is certainly the central figure in Parshas Chayesara. No one is spoken about more than him, and he is never called by name. There is no reference to Eliezer. We all know who he is, but the pasuk either calls him Ha'eved or Ha'ish. That's it. And in a sense, the reason why is because that is the greatness of Eliezer. That there is no Eliezer. He is a subject to the ideals and the goals of Avram Avinu. Whatever is good for Avram, his master, that's what's good for him. There is no Eliezer. He sometimes is called Eved, sometimes is called Ha'ish. And in fact, Rabbeinu Bachya discusses this. And to give us some type of way of navigating, why would he be called Ha'ish sometimes? Why Ha'eved sometimes? So Rabbeinu Bachya says that whenever we find Eliezer acting exactly in accordance with Avram's wishes, meaning not departing one iota one way or the other, even for the better good, he's called Ha'eved, and he just does what he's told. Sometimes he innovates. Now, of course, he's always innovating for a positive reason. The test, for example, Avram, which is like the center of the whole event, the test, give me to drink, Avram didn't tell him to do that. That was his own idea. And during that time, he's called Ha'ish, because there is a certain amount of initiative, but again, his initiative is only to bring forward to make sure that it has a positive outcome. So Eved becomes an Ish until the test is finished, and then he becomes an Eved again. That's more or less how it works. But there are one or two exceptions. In other words, this is the key that Rabbeinu Bachya gives. If he's just following Avram's instructions, just moving where Avram told him to go, he's the Eved. Anything else is Ish. A notable exception is in Pasuk Nunches. And let's take a look there. We're really all within Perek Havdalet, Pasuk Nunches. Rivka's family were very enthusiastic on the first day and less so on the second day. So we mentioned in the past, if I remember correctly, from the Shem Yishmuel, all the jewelry and all the valuables went to Rivka. The pasuk says that he gave their family migdonos. Migdonos means nice fruits. Nice fruits is not enough for Lavan's family. In other words, the gold and silver wasn't coming to them, and therefore their eyes are returned to their normal size, and they began to reconsider. So they said, maybe she should stay with us for a while. After all, it's a little bit hasty. Yesterday she said, be on your way. But today, they reconsider. Maybe she should stay yamim o asor. A year maybe, why not? A year, maybe a bit less, 10 months. Eliezer says, please, it has to be now. Call her and we'll see. So, what they said, right? Pasuk Nun Zayin, Vayomu, Nikra Lana Arav, Nishalai Espia. Let's call her and ask her. Vayikru Rivka, Vayomu Eleha, Haselchi Ima Ish Hazeh. Batomer Eleh. So they said, will you go with this man? She said, yeah. So, that was that. Now, what's interesting is, and Rabbeinu Bachya raises the question, we have just noted that as long as Eliezer is just going backwards and forwards to bring her back to Avram, etc., so then he's called an Eved. There's no initiative here, per se. And if that's the case, then why this is a departure from the rule? Because they refer to him as an Ish. Why? The answer, says Rabbeinu Bachya, is very simple. This occasion is not the Torah describing him, but the Torah presenting their description of him. That's altogether a different frame. As if to say, the Torah presents to us exactly what we need to know about what they said. But one thing is for sure, as much as the Torah will call him Eved and Ish, they're not going to call him an Eved. That's not nice. And therefore, within their expressions, they'll say, will you follow this gentleman? Right? Now we who know that, he's actually acting with Abram, call him an Eved. The Torah will call him an Eved, but they're not going to call him an Eved. It's not polite. And this, in a sense, highlights the sensitivity that we need to have when the Torah is speaking, and when the Torah is presenting things that other people said. Of course, the Torah is the ultimate presentation of what they said. Sometimes it will present things in the most crystallized way. Sometimes even attaching nuances that they themselves may not have been conscious of. Everything we need to know about what they said. So from their point of view, they would never call them an Eved. Well, you go with this Eved. Rav Kupperman, interestingly, who discusses many times the direct speech and indirect speech as one of his big topics. So he has something to add here, because as we mentioned before, the background to the question is they're looking to hold on to Rivka by this stage. In other words, they were enthusiastic yesterday, less so today. Now, if that's true, and they say, you know, and it was their idea, let's call Rivka, Nikra la Nara, Benishal Espia, let's ask her. Okay, now that sounds very fair on their part. But the question is, why are they so sure that she will want to stay with them? If they're the ones who are asking the question, presumably they will ask the question in a way that is most advantageous for their outcome. They don't want her to go with him. And therefore, even if we remain true to the difference in nuance between Eved and Ish, Eved means he is just an extension of Avram. And what you see is in a human embodiment of Avram Avinu's wishes. That's what Eved means. Ish means a bit of his own ideas. That's why they called him an Ish, because they're looking to sow within Rivka the notion, within her mind, the notion that maybe he isn't all that he presents himself to be. So far he said he's an Eved, it's very nice, but as far as we're concerned, maybe he's just an Ish. Who knows? So maybe it's not such a good idea. That's why they call him an Ish, because they're looking to portray him in a negative light. Maybe he's not entirely aligned with Avraham Avinu's plans. That's Rav Kupperman's explanation. And I thought perhaps that one may add a further nuance based on this. Namely, the Pasuk reads, if we see how it what it says, Pasuk Nun Ches, Vayikru'u la Rivka, Vayomu Eileha, Hatelchi ima ish hazeh. Right, will you go with him? Vatomer, and she said, Eilech, I will go. Now, interestingly, by way of preface, Rashi has a comment. Rashi's comment is, Vatomer, she says, Eilech, I will go, Me'atzmi, meaning I'll go anyway. Va'afim ein chemotzim, even if you don't want. That's how Rashi explains the word Eilech. Now, that's, in a sense, quite confrontational, maybe overly so. In other words, they say, would you like to go or not? Yes, and even if you don't want, I'm still going. I mean, that's quite forthright. Now, how does Rashi know this? Meaning, all she said was, I'll go. How does Rashi get this nuance of, I'll go even if you don't want me to? So I think the answer is very simple. I didn't have a chance to look in Mefarshi Rashi, but I'm sure that this is really at least part of the background. Because if there isn't more to her answer than just yes, she should have said yes. Meaning, they say to her, Hatelchi me'ishazeh? Are you going to go with him? The answer is yes. Batome came. Why does the pasuk not say came, but rather eilech? Eilech gives her a spontaneity. That means that what she's saying is, she's not just saying yes because, you know, it could go either way, but I'm happy to go with him. Eilech becomes now unilateral. I'll go regardless, even if you don't want. Eilech, it's me. That's what Rashi is responding to. And that's that. Now I mention that because I think that's now that we see that the word Eilech is really the less intuitive word, because it really just sort of said Cain. So when we come back to our understanding that they're looking to portray Eliezer in a negative light, Atelchim, are you going to go with this Ish? That's why she doesn't say Cain. Because if the word Ish is looking to cast aspersions on his integrity, then for her to say yes to that question means that she accepts the premise of the question. But when she says Eilech, which begins now a new conversation, really what she's saying is, I'm going and I'm not responding to your question. Because to respond to your question would mean that I'm concurring with what's behind it, which I do not. Because you call him an Ish, and if I say yes, then, you know, it's like answering the question, are rumors of, you know, the allegations of your embezzlement true? So even if you say no, you've been, you know, incriminated yourself. So there can't be a no. There can't be not yes, certainly, and no. So even not no. So really they're saying, are you going to go with the suspect person? You can't say yes to that. She's saying I'm going, meaning erase the premise behind your question. I do not recognize any impugning of his character. So I think that is that would further, perhaps try and check in with our Kupmer later in the week to see if he agrees with that, and I hope that he will. But these are some of the Ha'aras. There's a great deal. It's very compacted. As much as it's a long parsha, relatively, in many psukim, 69 psukim, I think, is his parak. But nonetheless, in terms of all of the negotiations and the retellings, there's a great deal to keep our eyes open for. Now, I just wanted to conclude by referring to a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which talks about Avram Avinu. The Mishnah states in Perikei, Kol mishiyesh biyado shalosh midos halalu, whoever has the following three midos, so he is a Talmud of Avram Avinu. And if he has the opposite three midos, so he's a Talmud of Bilam Harasha. What are the three positive midos? The most wonderful things. Ayin Tova, positive outlook. Ruach Nemucha, a low spirit, meaning humble. Nefesh Shefala, they're in control of their physical desires. That's Avram Avinu. And if you have that, you're a Talmud of Avram Avinu. And if you have the opposite, haughty and out of control and stingy and jealous and all of those things, so then you're a Talmud of Bilam Harosh. That's the Mishnah, and we all know that Mishnah. So what's interesting is, it's maybe a very simple question, but aside from the question, you know, I mean, is that the only thing that you could get from Avram? I mean, there's nothing else that identifies you as a Talmud of Avram Avinu? There is no mention, by the way, of any faith issues or of any philosophy or anything. It's just a question of positive character traits, negative character traits. That's the only thing that differentiates Avram from Bilam. But another very interesting question is, it's interesting that if you have these three midos, you're a Talmud of Avram. A Talmud of someone means that you received something from them. Now the premise then is that anyone who has good character traits received it from Avram. Is that necessarily true? If they came in contact with Avram, presumably they'd receive. But maybe they've developed their character traits until they're good people, and we say, oh, Talmud of Avram. Who's Avram? I'm happy to meet another person like me, but I mean, I didn't know about him. I didn't. And especially for Bilam, I mean, without putting too fine a point on it, what do we mean to say? Anyone who is stingy or uncontrollable or jealous or haughty, you know who their Rebbe was. Bilam, they learned it from him. Many of them are self-made men. They really discovered it by themselves. They didn't need to take a course from Bilam. But the Mishnah says that they're Talmidim. So that's an interesting shaila. The Gemara says in Maseches Bava Basra, in Daf Tes Zayin Amud Beis, most unusual statement. Even Tova Haisa Teluya Betzavar Shel Avram Avinu. There was a precious stone that was suspended from the neck of Avram. The Kol Mishaya Chola, anyone who was sick, anyone who was sick could just look at it and they would be healed. And then the Gemara goes further and says, and when Avram passed away, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took that stone and he threw it into the sun. That's a statement that needs to be understood. What does it mean? Rav Shlomo Fischer, Shlita, based on comments of the Vilna Gaon in his Perush to Mishlei, where the Pasuk says, as we know, Shema b'ni musar avicha, v'alti tosh toras imecha, the Pasuk enjoins the individual, listen to the teachings of your father, listen to the teachings of your mother. And the Pasuk proceeds, ki libyaschein heim l'roshecha, they're an adornment to your head, v'anokim l'gaga rosecha, and they are pearls around your neck. Those are those two Pasukim. So musar avicha and toras imecha become livios chen l'roshecha, adornment for your head, va'anokim l'gaga roshecha, and pearls around your neck. The question is, why those two things? And the Vilna Gaon explains, as a matter of generality, typically, it is the mother who more molds the character of the child. She's the one who's paying attention to how he carries himself, how he behaved, does he please and thank you, and all of those things. The father may take more of a formal interest in terms of expression, but the character of the child, that's why minhagim are basically covered by the pasuk al titash teres imecha, because the minhagim of a kihila are their character, they're the unique feature. They're like the minhagim are like their mother, making sure they're dressed well and all of these things. The father, his interaction tends to be more in the formal schooling of ideas and thoughts. Musar avicha and Torah simecha refer to developing the mind and developing the heart. And that's why the pasuk says, ki liv yaschein hem l'roshecha, they're an adornment for your head. If you listen well to musar avicha, to the instruction of your father, and if he's a good instructor and you're a good student, so you'll end up with a good head. And if you listen to your mother, Torah simecha, so then you will end up with pearls around your neck. Why? Because, says the Gaon, pearls around the neck rest on the heart. And therefore all of those middos, which are strung together, are an adornment for the heart, because a person who has heeded the instruction of his mother has a good heart. Says Rav Shlomo Fischer, everyone was beset in Avram's time with Avodah Zarah and confusion and ignorance, and nothing was happening till Avram enters the scene. And what's interesting is the chiddush of Avram, that there is one God and there's a way to live. It sounds very simple. And the more you look around the world and you see as Avram, and every child knows how Avram made his deductions. And it makes perfect sense until a person's desires get in the way. Whereby if there really is a correct way to live, that means that I'm not the boss anymore and I can't do what I want. And we know what the Torah has told us about the Isser of Shochad, of receiving a bribe. As soon as there's a vested interest for you, your vision is skewed. Even if you're a wise person, ki ha-shochad ye'aver einei chachamim, you may as well be blind, even if you're a chacham. And therefore consider, if we can begin to magnify the shochad, the bribe, that a life where I'm my own boss and I can do what I want versus someone else is the boss and I have to do what they want, the difficulty that will exist within making a balanced decision. That's why Avram's, it could be that other people beforehand thought, before Avram thought, you know, how does the sun work and how does the moon work and all of these things. So how did Avram carry the day? It's the string of pearls around Avram's heart. In other words, around his neck, resting on his heart. Avram's positive character traits meant that he wasn't afraid of hearing the answer that maybe there really is a higher responsibility. And if that's the case, so be it. So that means I'm not the boss. So be it. That was the Even Tova. This was the biggest chiddush of Avram. And anyone who was sick, as the Mefarshim explains, sick meaning that their hashkafas were all askew, if they would only look to Avram, if they'd be inclined to look to Avram and see the way forward as he had paved it, they could become cured. Avram says, if you're prepared to work on your character, so then things will open up for you, even the way that you look at the world. And Avram really showed them how to look at the world. That's why when he died, the stone was thrown back into the sun. In other words, Avram has shown you how to look at the sun. He's shown you how to look at the world. But what's fascinating is, it sounds so easy, and yet, not everyone went for Avram's path. In fact, amazing as it is, you know, you think if Avram lives down the road, everyone around him will be his Tamidim. Down the road from Avram was Sodom. And they remained the people of Sodom. They were not part of his Beis HaMedrash. Why not? The answer is because they weren't interested in pursuing the way of life of Avram, and therefore there was no traction, there was no cohesion between the two. So they lived within a few kilometers of Avram, was the city of Sodom, and he's Avram, and they're them, and never the twain shall meet. When the Mishnah says, if you have three qualities, you're a Talmud of Avram, what it means is, this is the type of person who would become a Talmud of Avram. Because otherwise, you'd probably avoid him. Because everything he says will make you feel uncomfortable. So what will attract you to Avram? You'll be attracted to Avram if you have an affinity for his way of life. But that will require at least some resonance of a positive outlook, humility, and all of these things. Those people will become Talmidim of Avraham. Bilam is the polar opposite, whereby Bilam is in a time of revelation, of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and you can still be Bilam. It takes some doing, and you still have Talmidim. Who would turn a blind eye, literally, to the goings-on of Yetzias Mitzrayim and persist in following Bilam? Who will become a Talmud of his? The answer is, if your midos are corrupt, Ruach Gavoa, so you'll make it your business to ignore everything else that's going on, and you'll make a beeline for Bilam's Beis HaMedrash. So these are important for us to know, as much as the much vaunted objective judgment of the world, as we know, is rare, is such a thing. For everybody sees things that are advantageous for them, and there is no question, therefore, that the example that is set by Avram Avinu, not only in terms of his ideas, but also to pursue the way of life of Avram, to look at the stones around his neck, to strive to emulate that, and then all of Avram Avinu's ideas will become clear to us. Leave it over.